In our lineage tradition, through Suzuki Roshi and Dogen and Dongshan, these wonderful Chinese ancestors, Weinang, we trace our lineage back to Bodhidharma, the Indian teacher who supposedly brought the Zen stream of Buddhism to China. Now, there's a lot of stories and myths about Bodhidharma. On one hand, we have the scholars who say, well, he didn't really exist. There's no real proof that such a person actually existed. But then on the other hand, there's the stream of those of us who've been practicing this way in historical times. Those of us who are alive today now, and of course Suzuki Roshi and Dogen, but many, many Zen teachers prior to that, give the stature of Bodhidharma some paramount importance. So in my practice, it's been important for me to not to rely upon merely what the scholars say, nor merely take it on faith, although faith is an important part of our practice, to try to discern for myself what is the essence or the importance, or what aspect of this Bodhidharma figure can I, and hopefully share with others, can we bring to life in our practice? I trust that you've heard the story, or the primary story from the Zen tradition, of Bodhidharma's encountering Emperor Wu. Can I presume this?
Not necessarily.
Okay, let's see if I can recall it. But first, let me give you a little bit of background about this Emperor Wu. His reign in the 500s, more or less, in China, 500s AD. The Emperor Wu was quite an extraordinary fellow because he, unlike most all the other Chinese emperors, and there have been many over the millennium, he was a devout student and practitioner of Buddhism. He was no lightweight. He had seriously tried to abdicate his position as the emperor, if I understand correctly, to just be a follower of the way, to live a simple, humble life. But it wasn't meant to be in the imperial court. Come on back. But in his reign, he apparently oversaw the construction of many, many temples, like hundreds of Buddhist temples. And he oversaw or allowed or facilitated the ordination of many hundreds, maybe even thousands of men and women to be monks and nuns to practice. And he personally had very astute advisors, adept advisors, and he held frequent discussions and, you know, Dharma discussions to try to ferret out what was the essential point of Buddhism. Now, to put it in a historical context, if we can assume that Shakyamuni Buddha's lifetime was 500 years before our current era, and that Emperor Wu and Bodhidharma's time was approximately 500 years into our Christian era, then we're talking about 1,000 years, 1,000 years of Buddhist practice in India and China. So once again, Buddhism had already been introduced to China in a fairly substantial way, 500 years around the turn of the Christian era. So unlike, in a way, our time, when we're trying to figure, some of us maybe growing up never heard of Buddhism. And it certainly is not, nowadays, I think young people growing up certainly can have heard of it. But it's still, if you think about our culture and Western culture in general, even including Chinese and Japanese Oriental culture, the practice of Buddhism is maybe not so well known, even in China and Japan today. Well, in Japan it's well known, but there's some question of how sincerely the practice is manifested. I'm sure it is sincerely practiced, but it's maybe not so widely spread. So if you could imagine America or the West, what would our country or culture be like with 1,000 years of Buddhism? Generation after generation of people devoting their lives to study, to practice, to try to discern what are the essential teachings. I mean, to me, that in itself would be a remarkable feat. And so again, I'm trying to find my own way between what historically we hear to be the case and what I can imagine might be the case. But what is the case for us here? Again, a little sidebar, when we think of Suzuki Roshi's coming to the United States, Buddhism in Zen was somewhat known. Many people, as I was coming of age in the 60s, had read D.T. Suzuki and Alan Watts. But when I first got the inkling that there was a possibility to practice Buddhism, there were no practice centers in the West. And yet, just about that time when I was becoming cognizant that there was such a thing as practice, Suzuki Roshi had landed in San Francisco, and he came, as many of you must know, to the Japanese temple in Japantown in San Francisco, and he set up shop, so to speak. Meaning that he was the priest of the expatriated Japanese community, but his real love was to practice, not merely to do funeral ceremonies and kind of hang out with the old folks. But if I understand correctly, he sat zazen every morning, and little by little, this ragtag bunch of hippies, artists, school teachers, ne'er-do-wells, came to this Japanese temple to inquire about practice. Would he teach? And he said, "I sit zazen every morning. You're welcome to join me." And after there was a significant group of people, and this may have been 20, 15, 20, I'm not sure, who had been practicing zazen regularly, a daily basis, then and only then did he begin to give teachings, give Dharma talks. So there's, anyway, so now let's go back to the Bodhidharma story. So here was Bodhidharma, a transmitted teacher in southern India who made the voyage to China and arrived in South China. And he was welcomed by Emperor Wu to have an interview. Now, we can imagine such a wonderful emperor as this Emperor Wu, to having been such a promoter and benefactor of Buddhism, of practitioners, monks, nuns, temples, that this would be a wonderful occasion for the emperor to meet such a, and I guess Bodhidharma was a renowned figure. Somehow his the importance of who he was had preceded him. Anyway, so the emperor warmly welcomed Bodhidharma. And supposedly, if story goes, the emperor told Bodhidharma, I've established all these temples. I facilitate all these men and women to become ordained. I've studied the sutras and translated the sutras, and this is what I've accomplished. He asked, what merit is there for me having done all this? Bodhidharma said so clearly, no merit. And the emperor said, well, what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? And let me give a sidebar on this one. This was, it seems like when we read the case, it seems, oh, that's easy. This is a slide right by that. But no, I'd like to pause for a moment here. When we think of the 500 years after Shakyamuni Buddha's demise in India, a very fertile time with hundreds, maybe thousands of people studying, practicing, and the Indians, as some of you have been there or may know about Indian philosophy, they love to dive into issues and pull them apart and try to find and to the essence and to categorize all the myriad aspects of mind, of what Buddha's enlightenment was, all that stuff. And the two major field of study in this Buddhist realm were the Madhyamaka field, Madhyamaka school, and the Yogacara. The Madhyamaka school, as you may know, our Heart Sutra comes out of the Madhyamaka understanding of the Prajnaparamita, that form is emptiness, emptiness is form, and there's nothing more deeply substantial behind that. There are many ways of articulating that, as the teachings of Nagarjuna and the whole Madhyamaka school have brought forth, and are still wonderful, wonderful, fruitful areas to study if you're so inclined to study that stuff. The Yogacara school, somewhat by contrast, the yoga of the Yogacara, the yoga part of it means they were actually practicing what we can assume was something very similar to our Zazen practice. That they're the basis of their, you might, if we can call it, philosophical inquiry into the Dharma was through the direct experience of this body and mind. In other words, again, a simple contrast was the Madhyamaka said, ultimately, there's nothing here. There's nothing we can get our hands on. But they said it in such a fabulously articulate, brilliant way. And they said it many ways. The Yogacharan said, hey, just practice. And let's see, when we practice, what comes forth. And let's try to understand that. So, in the Yogacharan scheme of things, if I understand correctly, they come up with it. There's not just one truth. There's two truths. There's the fundamental truth that can't be spoken of, cannot be spoken. And then there's the truth of our everyday life that we can not only speak about, but we can study and we can articulate. And they did. They articulated volumes, vast volumes and sutras and commentaries about what the truth is from that point of view. So that we seem to have then this dichotomy of the ultimate truth, sometimes called the absolute truth that can't be spoken, and the relative truth, that which can be spoken and which can be studied and articulated. So apparently what Emperor Wu and his advisors were studying was this notion that the highest meaning of these two truths is that they're not different. And that's remarkable in itself, that the absolute truth and the relative truth, somehow, they're the same. Okay, and I don't want to go into extrapolating that, but going back to the story then. So So the emperor, somewhat we might feel, as I have felt, was taken aback by Bodhidharma's abrupt comment that all his work and all his largesse and magnanimity of starting temples and ordaining people and studying all these sutras. And when the Bodhidharma, when the emperor was looking for, well, notice, Bodhidharma cuts him short and says, no merit. So the emperor says, well, what is the highest meaning of these two truths? Sometimes said the holy truths. Bodhidharma says, empty, no holy. Sometimes translated as vast emptiness, no holiness. And again, the emperor is taken aback and he says, well, who are you standing in front of me? And Bodhidharma says, I don't know. And then left. The story continues on to say that Bodhidharma then left the southern kingdom of Wu, Emperor Wu's kingdom, and crossed into northern China, crossing the Yangtze River, and sat in a cave for 9 years. It's a great story. I mean, just hearing that story myself as a young man, it's like, whoa, he sat in a cave for 9 years. Strong. Could we do that? Could I do that? Can anybody do that? Dogen, somewhere, I tried to find out exactly where I read this and I can't find it. Dogen said, well, maybe he sat for only 2 years. Maybe he sat for only a year. But even if he only sat for 2 weeks, what Bodhidharma did and what he's somehow legendarily known for is that the importance of our sitting, just sitting. Not looking for something, not trying to get something, not trying to sort out the chickens from the ducks, not trying to figure out the ultimate truth from the relative truth, just sit. And so we do, as Suzuki Roshi did when he came. And in this story of Suzuki Roshi coming, he first established sitting practice. And after or to this small group of people who were sitting with him, then he began to unfold the Dharma. So one of the things, again, is I try to fathom back in time through the myth and the stories and the mists about who is Bodhidharma. That whatever length of time he sat, somehow consolidated all of the Buddhist teachings prior to that time into this figure, this upright, immovable figure, sitting zazen. And out of that just sitting, unfolded and came to flower the great, this wonderful centuries of incredible, just really blossoming of the experience and expression of our Zen practice in China. It carried over into Japan through Dogen and others. It was transmitted through hundreds of years in Japan, and brought by Suzuki Roshi across the Great Pacific to sit down in a little corner of San Francisco, sitting his daily zazen. And out of that sitting grew Tassajara, grew, of course, the San Francisco Zen Center, Tassajara, and now after, what is it, 40, 50 years, many, many Zen centers all over the country and around the world. So there's something that essential that I'm continually drawn to. As wonderful it is to give talks, hold seminars, study groups, to do all kinds of practices in a sense, we could say that the essential quality of our practice comes down to just this upright, immobile sitting. So again, I think when we start out, we're confronted by, in the stillness of sitting, this incredible stuff that wells up from within. Thoughts and feelings and emotions and aches and pains, and whether the pains are physical or psychological or emotional, so many of us initially are confronted by a wall of discomfort. And so there's obviously an eager keenness to want to find some relief from this. Oftentimes we approach practice in the first place, just there's got to be some way to relieve this suffering I so intensely feel. And our teachers, virtually without exception, say, first of all, sit down. Sit down like this. And again, in our American Western evolution, many of us need to sit on chairs. And I notice someone is sitting, lying prone. These, of course, are also equally valid ways to somehow enfold all of our body and mind, all of our field of awareness, and just do this one thing. So even though I may say, just sit, I understand that this just sit can be expressed in different ways. So I'd like again to do another little so-called sidebar and talk about it is maybe reflective of the dialogue between Bodhidharma and Emperor Wu, but two in the lineage through Baikroshi that I've been practicing and studying with, that he has articulated and I found extremely useful, is to distinguish, and you may have your own version, definition of these words, but let me share with you what I'm familiar with, is how we distinguish awareness on one hand and consciousness. Now consciousness, which is so familiar to all of us, if we look at the nature of consciousness and we ask, what is its function? What is its purpose? What does consciousness do? One simple response is that consciousness, by nature, divides this from that, me from you, from the world, right, wrong, day, night, good, bad, up, down. And of course, our world runs on that, depends on that. And in our world, it's absolutely essential to have a sense of self, to know who you are. If we don't know who we are, we don't have a sense of my own particular personal responsibility, if we don't keep track of, if we don't organize, manage, our dreams and desires, and we don't manage our aversions and our confusions, then we're pretty lost. So yes, the sense of self, the function of consciousness, is absolutely essential. And most of our culture, not necessarily 100%, but a high percentage, you might say, is totally involved in the realm of consciousness. But one of the things that the great Indian yogi practitioners discerned, who knows, 2,000, 3,000 years ago, back before recorded history, there were yogic practitioners, yogis, who understood something about this state of mind, that when it's calm, it's still, deeply alert, that a different quality of mind is accessible. that's not, that's freed from, liberated from this perpetual stream of consciousness of wants and desires and aversions and confusions. This is the nuts. So in a way, at the risk of oversimplifying, we might say, going back to the Emperor Wu Bodhidharma story, that Bodhidharma, and again, this is again most useful for me somewhat, to kind of give some form or shape to this myth or this story of Bodhidharma and the Emperor. So if Bodhidharma represents that quality of awareness, it's not something we have to go after. It's not something we're going to find out and get later. It's not something that we had once and then now we don't have. This field of awareness, this sense of immediacy of our sensory sphere, before thought arises, this is always present with us. The nature of consciousness, as we understand, if you sit for a while and you begin to notice it, the nature of consciousness rises almost immediately when we sit down. So it does take some work to find a way to shift attention from our watching the TV screen of consciousness to abide in this body with the senses wide open, still, in stillness and alertness. This is the immediate access to this undefined, unlimited field of awareness. So again, going back to the Bodhidharma Emperor Wu story, the nature of consciousness within our conscious and the root the basis of our karmic life, there's bad karma and there's good karma and there's neutral karma. And the emperor, we might say, was involved in very seemingly wholesome karma, that he was doing all this seemingly wonderful stuff, but he was still looking to find something to aggrandize himself, perhaps, we might say. And Bodhidharma's retort was, no, there's nothing. If we're looking for something extra, if we want some acclaim for our accomplishments, forget it. Just the practice, just to bring forth this field of awareness, that is already complete, already completely connected with the entire world. Nothing need be added. So our zazen, while we may spend time sorting through our conscious baggage, we are continually reminded that this point of zazen, fundamental point, is just to be present. It's not that we're trying to get rid of something, but when we can find this presence of mind in stillness, in wakefulness, ready, alert, calm, this is the beginning of the flowering of our, and ripening of our practice. Always available, always present. So going back, one last wrap up of this story between Bodhidharma and the Emperor. What is the highest meaning of the holy truths? The Emperor asked. Bodhidharma said, vast emptiness, no holiness. We might think he's advocating nihilism. Is he? He gave expression in a very succinct, concise, decisive way. So the expression, and this is part of what brings us back to our ceremony this afternoon, so we, all of us, each of us, embodies these two truths, our everyday life and our everyday mind, our deeply ongoing cultivation of this fundamental truth of just being open, alert, ready. And that from within this seeming two different states of mind, we give expression. Whether it's I don't know, or vast emptiness, or no merit, something can be said. And each one of us now has that opportunity to say something to embody our two truths. Thank you.
Can we ask the questions now?
Sure.
You have a question?
Is it possible to live with 1 foot in one world and 1 foot in the other? In 1 foot in consciousness, 1 foot in awareness.
You know, I like to think of it as computer code. 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1. If the zero is a sense of openness, readiness, no expectation, and the one is where we need to do something, if we have, as we cultivate in our sitting practice, and it takes some work to see what is the functioning conscious mind that separates, and what is that field of awareness that is already connected in this whole. So we don't necessarily need days, hours, years, months to figure that out. It's not obvious, but it's always with us. So if we can understand that turning point between zero and one, then I would say yes. Whether it's 1 foot or 1 0, but yes.
So are you saying that in time, moving into the realm of time, that this is an alternating, a phasing in and out, or that we're not in the realm of time and that everything is simultaneous?
I like to think of it as simultaneous, but we do have a choice where we focus our attention. There's a classic example. If you say you go into a bar or a dive joint cafe, and there's a big screen TV on, and the noise is up, and you go in with your friend, and you want to have an intimate conversation with your friend, but there's that big screen, the TV with the flickering images and the kind of booming voice. So you're focused on your friend, but then almost invariably, you turn to look at that. And you have to come back, that kind of thing. So it's not that we need to get the gun out and shoot the TV, like to maybe. Or you tell the proprietor, look, can you turn that off? I just want to have a tete-a-tete with my dear friend. But as hard as that may be, if we can see that difference, and that's a gross exaggeration, but there's that the realm of consciousness is so enticing, absolutely drawn to it, like a moth to a flame. But we don't have to go there. So it does take some effort. And what better environment than sitting in a zendo to see that? And again, a simple way, it seems simple, maybe not so simple, is can you sense, let's take one sense field, like the visual field. Eyes are closed, open them, just see. In a sense, the field of awareness can take in the whole space, whole field, without having to name. Oh, there's people here. Oh, we're in a zendo. Oh, the lights are on. Oh, the flowers on the altar. Just see it. And yet, very quickly, almost imperceptibly, we can break it down, and then the consciousness enters. Oh, most everybody's got a Roxo. I mean, for example, and you start to name and then particularize, and already you're separating out. So just to begin to notice how consciousness functions is an extremely important step in our practice. How we embody and allow this field of awareness to be vivid and present and to vitalize our lives. The opportunity is always there, but it's not necessarily obvious. Okay? Yes.
Expanding on that binary thought of the zero and the one, zero relative, one absolute, infinite consciousness.
Or the other way around.
I'm getting there. So infinite decimals, fractions in between of consciousness, zero and one, maybe not linear, but circular, and zero and one being the common point.
I'm sorry? Cynic.
I'm with him.
let me try to say something else. How I understand what maybe you're trying to say, but maybe you're not. Okay.
I'm saying that you have zero and one. They could be relatives, absolute, interchangeable. In between there, infinite fractional points. Maybe that's consciousness. Maybe it's not.
Every day, you all, I believe, as I do, we recite the Heart Sutra. Now, I don't want to go into this in great detail, but I think there's a really, for me, astoundingly important teaching within the Heart Sutra. We call it the five skandhas. Sometimes I like to think of them really as the five wisdom skandhas, five emptiness skandhas. We say form, feelings, perceptions, and in my Zendo we say impulses, you say formations. Forms, feelings, perceptions, formations, impulses, consciousness. To begin to understand how they're distinct is also really important because they embody, as I understand, this field of form. Another way of saying it's not just things out there, it's the raw data of the universe, impacting the senses. Before there's a separation of outside and inside, of me, the observer, and that is the observed. So form, where I'm coming from, is tantamount to awareness. Just being there, whole world, not cut off, not chased after. Consciousness, going through these intermediary steps, as you're perhaps pointing out, this is the definitive point that's separation. Classic, you and me. This and that. But actually, experientially, we can see how they're distinct and different. It's really, really hard when you look at it through the microscope of your investigative still mind to find their boundaries. So in a sense, they're all happening at once. Yet we can distinguish them. Our attention usually is drawn to that. And that's where we live. So Buddhism is saying, the Hartress is saying, look at all of these five skandhas. Find out what they are. For me, this impulse is, to understand the impulsive or your formations is extremely important. Sanskrit is samskara. The kara part is karma. This is the karma maker. This is where we get into trouble. But with a mind of some wisdom, some mind of reflectivity, then this can become our intention, our deep intention. Bodhidharma's intention coming to China. Suzuki Roshi's intention coming to America. Not for naught. So when these five skandhas are illuminated, they're not something to be dismissed, as some people like to do. Well, we'll get rid of the five skandhas, now let's get into the real business. No, this is where we live. But if we're not alert and aware of these, then we usually, by default, fall into consciousness. That's understandable. So it takes some extraordinary effort to sit and cultivate stillness with alertness and discernment to unfold the depth, the richness of our practice. Yes?
Now, some point in the heart sutra said, no consciousness, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. And then, what is?
Doesn't it say, in emptiness, there's no eyes, no ears, no nose? From the point of view of emptiness, from the point of view, if we can say, if I can make that extrapolation, from the point of view of just awareness, then we're not distinguishing these, though they're all present. So not that we get rid of them. And if I don't know what the exact language of your sutra says, but I think our translation in Crestone is, in emptiness, therefore in emptiness, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no Buddhism, no suffering, no cause of suffering, no stopping of suffering, no path, no attainment. From here, we don't need to go after something. We're not. But when we're familiar with this realm, and then we can discern. Because we have to, I think, it's really essential to study our life. Otherwise we die and, well, we're on the verge of death. Well, God, I could have looked at my life, but I was always looking at TV. Anyway, I think that's the essence of the triple treasure. That there are teachings, there's teachers, and there's a wonderful Sangha. Incredible support to do this kind of study, practice, and expression. How we do things is how we express our deep understanding. Even though we may not think it's deep, already just to sit down on a cushion is the gateway to deep practice.